Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Jonah Moberg.
And I'm J.P. Pogorski. Today we are discussing restrictions on styrofoam in Albany.
Then we meet with John Amidon to discuss the Qatari Peace Conference.
Afterwards, we'll learn about the effort to divest New York State pension funds from fossil fuels.
And later on, we'll hear from Nick Vanderkolk, producer of the podcast Love and Radio.
And finally, we learn about local horticultural organization Troy in Bloom. Let's start the show off with some headlines. The White House announced that President Trump wants to delay a planned follow-up meeting with Vladimir Putin of Russia until after the investigation of the special counsel Robert S. Mueller is concluded, which he predicted would be next year. Last week, Mr. Trump unexpectedly said he would invite Mr. Putin to Washington in the fall, a move that some interpreted as a show of defiance by Mr. Trump after a storm of criticism over his meeting with Mr. Putin in Helsinki, Finland. Said the president's national security advisor, John R. Bolton, the president believes that the next bilateral meeting with President Putin should take place after the Russia witch hunt is over.
Pakistanis are voting today in what will be the second time in the country's 70-year history that power is transferred from one civilian government to the other. The voting got off to a tragic start. At least 31 people were killed in a suicide bombing outside a polling station in the city of Quetta.
The Ecuadorian immigrant, who was held for deportation after delivering pizza to a Brooklyn Army installation, walked out of an immigration detention center house hours after a judge ordered his immediate release.
President Trump has announced up to $12 billion in emergency relief for farmers whose sales have been hurt by the Trump administration's escalating trade war. The Agricultural Department said it will use an existing program to provide billions of dollars in direct payments to farmers and ranchers as a, quote, short-term solution, end quote. Criticizing the proposed relief measure as a taxpayer-funded bailout, Senator Ben Sasse, a Republican from Nebraska, has said, quote, "This trade war is cutting the legs out from under farmers, and the White House's plan is to spend $12 billion on gold crutches."
The Buffalo News reports that Erie County Sheriff Timothy B. Howard on Wednesday questioned why county lawmakers believe the State Commission of Correction when it says gross incompetence led to the death of an inmate in the Erie County Holding Center he oversees. "Why are you so willing to accept as true what is so much more than an opinion?" Howard said of the detailed 33-page report from the Commission of Corrections Medical Review Board. Cummings died at age 27 from a combination of maladies, the State Commission of Corrections said in a report made public days ago. But the agency said that she would have lived had the holding center's key medical and mental health staff intervened, as she lay babbling in a puddle of urine and provided with proper health care.
The transfer of funds by Democrat Don Boyajian from his defunct congressional bid to a state assembly effort has his primary opponent calling foul. A supporter of Democrat Tristra Hotling sent a complaint to the enforcement arm of the State Board of Elections. The two Democrats will compete on September 13th for the party's nomination to take on Republican incumbent Jake Ashby, who was elected in April to the 107th Assembly District, which includes parts of Washington, Rensselaer, and Columbia counties.
The New York Civil Liberties Union launched a website Wednesday aimed at increasing transparency on what policies local police departments use to govern their operations, including Albany's. The policies, requested from 23 departments across the state, include items such as diversity, surveillance, use of force, police misconduct, and more. The site also offers data for certain items and time periods as well, as NYCLU analysis on whether it believes individual policies are strong enough. The website address is Behind the Badge, New York, and that Behind the Badge, ny.org.
And if you missed it, you're listening to WOOC's Hudson Mohawk Magazine on 105.3 FM.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, you can text us at 518-888-3004.
Nick Vanderkolk, the producer of the podcast Love and Radio, visited the Uptown Summer Youth Employees at the Sanctuary for Independent Media and discussed podcasting techniques as the youth prepare to create audio stories of their own.
It's worked out for me pretty well, but like I kind of did everything opposite like how you should.
I kind of grew up listening to a lot of sort of public radio.
One thing that they teach you in that kind of genre is that radio is a didactic medium. It's not enough to sort of present a story. You have to sort of, like, explain what it means, and you have to sort of explain everything. And that's a totally legit way of going about things. Like, there's a lot of stuff that I love that operates that way, but I personally always found that quite limited. And so even though the show has, like, evolved a lot over the last 13 years, it's always had that DNA in it of, like, I didn't want to tell people, like, what they were supposed to feel and what they were supposed to think. And so that's why there's very little of me in it, why you're just hearing this voice and people kind of have to piece it together kind of on their own, which I think can make for, like, a more powerful storytelling experience, for lack of a better term.
Do you think that radio has become less critical of itself? Radio or podcasts, they've become more narrative, more linear kind of storytelling. So do you think that it's, I mean, obviously it's changing.
Yeah.
Is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? What are your thoughts on that?
I'm pretty mixed on it. I mean, I think in some ways, when I was starting out, there was, like, so little competition out there. And you would think with more shows there's going to be, like, more diversity of approaches. But I think also, because there's money in there now, people want to do the thing that is definitely going to succeed. And they do end up sounding pretty similar. There are a lot of, especially in podcasting, there are a lot of shows that are just much easier to produce, mm-hmm. that are, like, kind of chat-based. And it's like people sitting in a room, and those require some work and thought to make still good, but it's much easier to get, like, advertisers for that. It's much easier to pitch that to, like, a network. I tend to record for hours and hours and hours and hours, and then that gets edited down. So I'd say each episode typically takes about a month of work.
How do you
typically, and this is just sort of how, this wasn't necessarily intentional, but you tend to hear a lot more questions as the story goes on, because it's also just like there's a certain style in sort of radio documentary, for lack of a better term, where you completely cut out the interviewer and it's just sort of this monologue. And I personally like to be reminded that there is someone else in the room that's asking questions, so that you have to have, like, a little bit of skepticism, I think. So I don't prep people other than to sort of describe the process and describe the show and say, you know, this is all pre-recorded, so, like, if you want to back up and go again, that's totally cool. And then we just kind of wing it. And then you just have to sort of respect their space and kind of let them sort of take the lead on sort of what they're comfortable with, you know. I don't get to do face-to-face interviews all that much these days, but it's also it's, like, relatively easy, too. Like, now you can kind of interview people from wherever. And there's lots of great tools where they can kind of mic themselves as well. Like, now we have advertisers, we have some resources, so we can usually get, like, an engineer to go and record the person in person. And so I'll interview them over the phone, or a producer of mine will interview them over the phone, and someone else will be in the room with them recording them. Mm-hmm. And then we combine the tape together, mm-hmm. so it basically sounds like they're in the same room. That's called a tape sync. In general, I do two-hour interviews. The first one tends to have very little structure to it, where I'm really just kind of, like, just following my own curiosity about the person and just having a discussion around it. The second interview, at that point, I have a better understanding of, like, what the shape of the story ought to be. So the second interview tends to be much more directed, just sort of like kind of the skeleton of the story. And then based on those two things, then we begin the process of editing. And in the process of editing, we tend to notice, well, there's this, like, actually, this question that, like, I actually hadn't really considered now that I'm, like, listening to him tell the story again. So let's go back and we'll ask him that. Or he didn't tell this thing he told this one story in a slightly confusing way. Maybe we can have him retell that piece. So then we do a third follow-up interview, and that one tends to be a bit shorter because we know sort of like, okay, we want to get this, and this, and then hopefully, like, we have everything that we need from that.
So one thing I heard that is very cool, is that you, as a radio artist and a storyteller, are using some other audio tracks to emotionally carry the story on. Could you talk about that a little?
We use music. There's a lot of kind of subtle stuff going on. We actually, like, we run the voice through filters. So we're just sort of creating that space. We're just, like, very focused on the audio and also just sort of how the audio interacts. If it is a piece that has, like, kind of rich audio elements, to begin with, I will be collecting the sounds in the moment. In terms of finding the subjects, it's, well, as the show has become more popular, we have relied more and more on kind of outside pitches. So, like, listeners will write in with ideas for stories, or radio freelancers who will pitch stuff to us. But before that, it really was kind of all over the shop. I mean, sometimes it was just, like, stories that, like, a friend would tell me, you know, oh, my neighbor, you know, down the block, like, he's a survivalist or whatever. I didn't actually do that story, but I don't know. But someone was telling me about that the other day. Sometimes it's, because we have this, like, slightly strange format, it's also very, very helpful for doing stuff that has been in the news to some degree. So, for instance, I did a story about a guy who was in his 20s, and his wife died of cancer. And before she had died, she had written out sort of like her life goals, and he had committed his life to finishing out her life goals. So, and a lot of it was like quite ambitious. It was like, get a PhD, run a half marathon, take a train across Canada. And he had been on a couple like TV shows, but just like these very quick little 4-minute segments where it was like, oh, here's this guy doing this crazy thing, you know, tell us a couple of things about it, okay, cool, bye. And I knew there was more of a long form story there, and I think he was like quite grateful to actually like take the time. Most of the people that I talk to are really happy with how things turn out, because I really give them the space and the time to talk things through in a way that you don't get in media generally. I'm sure we've all seen at some point some sort of like very combative interview between like a host and a guest. Maybe the guest is doing something wrong or whatever, but like then they serve no purpose other than to show that the host is like somehow morally superior, and I'm not interested in that, you know. If there is someone who's sort of like morally dodgy who I have on the show, I don't have them on the show so I can harangue them. I still want to understand them. Be out in the world and just like meeting random weirdos.
And open to serendipity.
And open to serendipity, yeah. I mean, especially in this day and age, like everything is like on the internet. And so it's very easy to have these like curated experiences in your lives. And sometimes it's nice to just like throw out the phone and just go for a walk and like see what the hell you happen upon, you know. The stories that I go after tend to be the ones where I don't know how I feel about them myself, you know. I don't go in with an agenda, and that often makes the best pieces, when it's like when your mind changes over the course of working on it. That's often the sign that you're onto something really good.
That was Nick Vanderkoek, producer of the podcast Love and Radio.
The 20th annual Kateri Peace Conference will take place on Friday and Saturday, August 17th and 18th. Joining us now to discuss this event is a regular Peace Bucket guest, John Amidon. John, can you give us an interview of the event?
Yes, we have a multiple kind of series of events happening on Friday afternoon at the Unitarian Church on Washington Avenue. We have a community reflection, and this will be based on the work of Joanna Macy, the work to reconnect. And Maureen Amund will be leading and facilitating Friday afternoon, and all of our presenters will be there joining in the discussion. And this is the 20th annual Kateri Peace Conference, so it's a very special conference, and we have a stellar cast of peace advocates. I mean, really exceptional people, no Nobel Peace Prize nominees. And one of them is Kathy Kelly from Voices for Creative Nonviolence. Another is Anne Wright, retired colonel from the military, and she was a U.S. diplomat who resigned over George Bush's war policies with Iraq and the invasion. We have Ray McGovern, who is formerly a CIA agent who briefed President Reagan and now works for peace, you know, understood the dark side's come into the light, so to speak. From locally, we have Rosemary Armeo, who's been on the roundtable and a professor at SUNY. And then we have William Rivers Pitt, who is senior editor of Truth Out, and Greta Zorro, a organizer from World Beyond War.
Wow.
So we have extraordinary speakers this year.
It sounds like you have an incredible cast of speakers, very esteemed and accomplished people. And I wonder what criteria you use or the conference uses to choose the speakers. What do you look for in a speaker for your conference?
We look for expertise. We also look for people who are truly advocating for peace and who are willing to speak the truth, even if it disagrees with the prevailing cultural sentiment. You know, so, I mean, these people, many of them, well, Kathy has been arrested multiple times, and Ray McGovern, and have walked the walk. I mean, have gone beyond just the ordinary writing and speaking, but have traveled worldwide, have been to, like Kathy's been to Gaza many times, Iraq, Afghanistan. Anne's been all over the world. And even Rosemary Armeo just has returned from the Middle East herself. So we look for real life experience, and we look for anybody who demonstrates, you know, truth and a real understanding, in-depth knowledge.
One of the big things happening in the world today is the conflict between North and South Korea. How much of the conference will center around that topic?
I don't know that much will center around North and South Korea this year. It depends on the speakers, and it also depends on the questions asked by the audience. So the theme of this year's conference is the fierce urgency of now, and the community reflection will, as I said, will be on the work that reconnects, and it's to revitalize and help empower people locally, help them find community, find their voice. And on Saturday, we have a series of panels that have been worked out, but for example, we did it thematically. So Rosemary Armeo and William Rivers Pitt are representatives from media. William Rivers Pitt, Truth Out, and Rosemary Armeo from the Roundtable and other media work here locally. Rosemary is a bit more mainstream than William, but they're going to do a discussing the aspects of media from the perspectives they have. And so each workshop or each panel will be discussing some aspect of their work, and we leave that up to our panelists. Like Kathy just returned from Afghanistan and the Middle East, so and she's been focusing on Yemen lately, where there's that terrible blockade and cholera epidemic and mass starvation, which is the result of, you know, the Saudi Arabia's war policy and U.S. support of Saudi Arabia. So getting back to North Korea, again, I'm not sure if anyone will be focusing on that. And it is a remarkably important issue because of the nuclear concerns that we all have. But as we also all know, The biggest violator of the non-proliferation treaty in the world is the United States, and unfortunately, we've dedicated $1 trillion to develop new nuclear weapons and restore our existing arsenal rather than disarm.
20 years is a long time to have a continuous or a recurring conference like this. I imagine in the early years you were focusing on the early Middle Eastern occupations and the invasion of Iraq and things like that, and now a long time has passed. How has the conference changed in those years, and what about our particular political moment is affecting this year's conference?
Well, the conference started out, actually, its roots are in closing the School of the Americas, and it started out in 98, and I was quite involved and still do some work on that issue, too, where we train soldiers at Fort Benning. And the School of the Americas is renowned for its ability to produce murderers, thugs, and people who overthrow their government.
It's sometimes known as dictator school, I think.
Yeah, the School of Dictators or the School of Assassins or the School of Coups was all our different names it was given over the years. It was kicked out of Panama. It was so vile that the Panamanians didn't want anything to do with it anymore. And then it moved to Fort Benning, Georgia. So that was the really early years, 98, 99, 2000. You know, and then obviously with 2001, 9/11, and the subsequent wars in Iraq, we started changing our focus to reflect the different issues of the war and opposing the war that were coming up. But we've also been diligent on trying to address some of the immediate local concerns, like single-payer health care, nuclear disarmament, depleted uranium issues, and we had that nuclear waste dump right in the heart of Albany
for a while. We have about 2 minutes left. So we want to talk about what can people do to participate in the conference. That you're going to, it's going to be held at the on Washington Avenue at the FUSA, the First Unitarian Church.
Right, and part of it. And then
you have a boat ride, too.
Right. We're going on a riverboat cruise that night with the Dutch Apple Cruise Line, 6:30 at the end of Madison Avenue. It's a modest price of $25. We have all of our speakers. We have terrific musicians, Sherry Bauer and Bob Green, Mark Emanation, Terry Robin. It's a three-hour cruise. It's a celebration of peace with music, and our speakers will present just a little bit and talk about what they're going to do on Saturday. Then on Saturday, we were up in Fonda, New York, at the Kateri Tekakwitha Shrine in Fonda, and we will have a full day of conferencing from 9 o'clock in the morning till 3:30. And then we break at 3:30, and you get to spend your evening however you like it. And there are all of the other events. If you don't have any money, please come. We'll host you. We'll give you a full scholarship, and we have modest donations for those. So we do have bills, so we'd like to pay them. But you can come for free to all of the other events except the riverboat cruise. And so it's going to be a grand time. I know many people are coming, and there are really unique people who are coming who aren't speakers. Like Sister Megan Rice was a person who did a last year's action on the Oak Ridge nuclear site a few years back and ended up doing 2.5 years in prison for it, but really showed how insecure the nuclear sites we have are. And this was supposed to be the Fort Knox of uranium storage. And, you know, an 83-year-old nun walked through the woods at night right up to the vault. So we have numerous other speakers coming who aren't presenting, but who will be there to share their knowledge and wisdom and just be part of the conference. It's going to be very special, and we hope you all can come and enjoy the
absolutely
remarkable.
Yeah, that sounds so exciting. Thank you so much for talking with us today.
Oh, it's great to talk with you guys, and thanks so much for all the good work you're doing.
Have a great night. That was John Amidon discussing the upcoming Kateri Peace Conference.
And for those of you who's fishing on the Baton Kill and the downpours, I'm J.P. Pogorski.
And I'm Jonah Moberg. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or a sour bone to pick, you can text us at 518-888-3004. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative and dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region. And now we have an update on the effort to divest New York State pension funds from fossil fuels.
So we're here with Jordan Dale, who is up there in Rockland County, is active with the Divest New York movement. Jordan, why are groups calling for the state and other public pension funds to be divested from fossil fuels?
To my mind, there are three reasons. The first is the moral reason. We live in an age where climate change threatens to destroy the planet and cause untold suffering among human beings. And the fossil fuel industry is what's causing climate change. It is immoral for us to be supporting the fossil fuel industry with our dollars and seeking to make money off an activity that is destroying the planet. There is the financial or fiduciary reason. We live in a world in which most of the world's countries, there's one notable exception, have committed to transitioning from fossil fuels to renewable energy sources. And as this happens, it is inevitable that the value of fossil fuel companies is going to go down. It's already happened with coal. People who are invested in coal lost a ton of money. We believe that it's only a matter of time before it happens with oil and gas as well. It is foolish for New York State, which has the stated policy also of transitioning to renewables, to be invested in an industry that is bound to lose money over the next some odd years. And the third reason is a leadership reason. Our country's federal government right now is dominated by the oil industry and a group of people who don't have a constructive climate change policy. And so if we in the United States are going to make a difference, it has to happen on the local level. New York State has a huge responsibility to be a leader in the absence of leadership from the federal government. And when New York State divests, it will pave the way for other states to divest, and it will raise a lot of consciousness among the people of New York State and the people of our country about just how dangerous climate change is.
Have any other governments or institution agreed to divest fossil fuels at this point?
Well, the most recent headline is that the country of Ireland has committed to divesting. Obviously, the city of New York is one of the big headlines in the past year. The city of New York is committed to divesting and is working on how to do that in a responsible way. The Catholic Church has advocated for divestment. Norway's Sovereign Wealth Fund, which is the largest fund in the world, $1 trillion. Norway is a country that has built its wealth on the oil industry. They have committed to divesting, and believe me, if the Norwegians understand that this is a smart thing to do, we should pay attention.
Now, in New York State, I understand that the present state controller has said that he thinks it's probably more effective if he remains with investment in companies like Exxon and Shell, and use the shareholder voting rights to try to pressure from the inside these companies to, change some of their practices with respect to climate change. How realistic do you think this approach is?
I think it's utter foolishness. Shareholder action can be very effective when it comes to things like making sure that there are more women on corporate boards. And the comptroller, in fact, should be commended for his work on things like that. but shareholder action cannot be used to get a company to change its core mission. And the core mission of fossil fuel companies is to extract fossil fuels from the ground and bring them to market where they are burned. This is destroying the planet. No amount of shareholder action is going to change that, and continued investment is going to help support it. So it's a foolish position, frankly. Given how smart the comptroller is about so many other things, it's incomprehensible to me that he still embraces that position.
Now, I understand earlier last year the governor did come out and supported the divestment. He himself does not have a direct role, but he has, with the comptroller, convened, I guess, a panel to look at sort of the issue of the climate impact of the state pension fund. What would you like to see come out of this process?
Well, I'd like to see the panel, for the reasons stated, take the position that divestment is the wisest public policy for the state pension fund to pursue. And I also would like to see Governor Cuomo ramp up his role. The governor can put divestment in the state budget, which would make it happen. His failure to do so is unfortunate. If he really believes in divestment, he has the ability to make something happen, and he should use that ability.
Now, in recent months, some of the unions representing various former government workers, particularly the police and the firemen, have raised questions that they worry that the act of divestment would actually, you know, cost them money. That I guess the pension value would go down if we didn't have fossil fuels like Exxon in it. How would you respond to some of those concerns?
Well, two responses. First of all, the pension benefits of state union employees are guaranteed by the state constitution. So even if divestment dilutes the strength of the pension fund, union members' pension benefits will not be harmed. And in fact, it's the taxpayers who would absorb that loss, not pension members. However, even more important is the fact that the investment fund is much more likely to do better without fossil fuels than with them. And in fact, having fossil fuels in the investment fund is an enormous liability. If oil and gas holdings end up doing what coal holdings have done, we're going to lose millions and millions of dollars. Corporate Knights did a study which showed that if New York State had divested when they were first asked to do so, they would have been $5 billion better off only 4 years later. And so I understand the concerns of our hardworking union employees, and I certainly would not want to do anything that jeopardized their benefits, but their benefits are not endangered by divestment, and their benefits are threatened, and all of the taxpayers are threatened if we continue to hold on to fossil fuel securities that are going to lose money.
If any of our listeners out there are interested either in getting more information about the issue of divestment and the role that fossil fuels play in climate change, or you know, want to make their voices heard on this issue, you know, what are some of the things they could do?
Well, we have a coalition which is called Divest New York, and they could reach out to Divest New York through the radio station. I can give my personal email address. It's Jordan, J-O-R-D-A-N, 93016 at iCloud.com. And another way is to reach out to 350.org and to ask them how to engage in the divestment effort. And we would welcome participation. This is a growing movement throughout the world, throughout the country, and New York State should be a leader. And this is a way to have a real immediate and profound impact on fighting climate change.
And Jordan, just to finish up, what's the name of your own local group that you're active with in Rockland? And you know, were you a financial expert or a scientist before you got involved with this?
No, I was a nonprofit executive who had absolutely nothing to do with science. I did, my organization did work with children, and because it worked with children, we cared about issues that impact children, and there was a certain institutional commitment to greening our corner of the world, but also to educating children about what they could do in, to make the future of their planet more safe and secure, and climate change therefore became something that we were aware of through that work. The name of my organization, the organization that I work in Rockland, is actually 350 New Jersey Rockland. And if you Google 350 NJ, that's where you find our website.
And thank you, Jordan Dale. And this has been Mark Dunley for WOOC.
That was the update on Divest New York's anti-fossil fuel efforts. Next, Julia Kavicki interviews Claire Bourne of Troy in Bloom, the group responsible for keeping downtown Troy green.
Claire Davis is the creator of the Troy in Bloom project. And I was wondering if, to start off, you could please just describe the project and the history of your involvement with it.
Yes, I have to say, though, that Jim Lewis was also with me at the beginning, and so I have to give Jim credit, too. It started on a wintry night in 1993. Jim and I had attended a council meeting, and it was cold, it was miserable, and we discussed the previous summer. The city was in dire straits financially, and they couldn't afford to put any flowers in the planters. And we were very upset about that. So we decided that we would meet afterwards in a warmer spot and discuss what we could do. And so Jim and I founded Troy in Bloom. He's a wonderful artist, so he did a nice drawing for the top of a letter that I created and sent out. My recollection is I sent out about 350 letters asking for donations for flowers for the planters, and that was going to be for not only downtown but also the Berg. And I got back 6 responses. So that didn't work very well. So we decided that we had to raise the money independently, and so the way to do that was to put out canisters. So I went and asked all the friends for their coffee canisters, their coffee cans and so forth, and decorated them. And went over to the paint store on 4th Street, and they kindly gave me their old wallpaper books. And so I had this nice project of decorating the coffee cans and cut a hole in the top for the donations, and then made a stylized daisy out of construction paper and bought some long skewers, wrote Troy in Bloom Flower Project, and then put out 90 of these things throughout Troy and the Berg. And the money came in. And so I went around with my clipboard and wrote down all the money. Now, Bella Napoli was the number one spot. Everybody bought a confection or whatever it is and put the change into the pot in there. That was absolutely wonderful. So that was our start with volunteers, with everybody putting them in the canisters. And then I got friends and to come on Memorial Day weekend. And we had the 3 days to do our plantings. And that's how we got started on from a wintry night, just to help out the city to beautify it and so forth. So that was our beginning. That was it.
So where did you end up doing the first set of plantings? You said it didn't end up working out to have it all over Lansingburg and the other areas.
Eventually, it became too much to do Lansingburg, and there was a school teacher friend that I had, and I asked her if she would take over the Lansingburg part of it, because there were 90 spots, and it was just too much, you know, to handle, and I was doing all the collecting and so forth. And so did get the city to make more planters. We were very lucky. The city was working with Clemente Concrete, and Clemente had extra concrete, which they would just dispose of at the end of the day. And I worked actively with, well, now it's called Capital Roots, but it was Community Gardens at that time, with Amy and with Sharon. And they came up with a little grant for somebody to make a design for the planters. And we wanted a classical design, so that's how it got paneled. And we wanted to paint it some pink to put in to look like they were terracotta, because they were just gray. And Clemente went and made the things for us. And then they ran out of the dye, and we ended up with just gray ones. So we ended up getting more and more planters and so forth. So it became a bigger project over time. But Memorial Day weekend came by, and I had purchased the plants at several different nurseries and so forth, and had them all together in the parking lot by City Hall and the old City Hall, and sent them out with worksheets. And basically everything was planted in the first day of Memorial Day weekend on Saturday, with a little tweaking on Sunday and Monday. And that was it. And then crews would go out and they would water. That was tough. That was tough because splashing buckets of water in the back of your vehicle and so forth, and trying to get all the planters and that. So that's where it became very necessary that the Berg take over their own. And but we managed for quite a number of years with the volunteers. Then very kindly, the council members themselves had some discretionary funds, and they started to give something toward the purchase of the flowers, so I didn't have to be as aggressive as I was in the past in getting some of the money in. And then eventually the city took over with the funding. And we just kept on going. And I left the city 3 years ago to return to my family home in the Catskills, in Windham, in the northern Catskills. And since then, Marie Gavazzi and others have continued with the plantings, and I couldn't keep my hands out of them today. I was deadheading. So I'm still very connected to Troy. I left part of my heart in Troy, and so, but it's 25 years now, and I was involved in 22 of the 25 years very actively. So, and it was a gift to me to be able to do that for the city. I must say that people were very honest in the city. 99% of the time, the canisters stayed where they were supposed to be. On occasion, we had somebody pick up a canister, and Tom Carroll chased a young girl, a runaway girl. Unfortunately, she was had her problems and so forth, and he told me he had chased her down the street and had retrieved the canister and then found out that she had run away. And so she was taken to the police department, and it turned out there was $6.80 in the canister, and never got it back because it was police evidence, but she, I guess, was reunited where she had run away from. But that was the only time that I was aware that anything had happened. The poor girl was on hard times, and so I guess it was kind of a forgivable thing to do. But people just helped. They were just absolutely wonderful, and the contributions came in. There were extra things. People didn't realize that after a while we were getting some help from the city, and I would just receive a check for it. So it's a wonderful experience. People enjoyed them, and the city benefited by having those. So it was all very positive. Yes.
Well, you mentioned the plantings that were outside of the City Hall. There was a bit of a fiasco, I understand. That
there was. That. I had forgotten about that. Yes, I almost got arrested. Yes, along with a woman who was the wife of the dean of students at RPI. Because there was a change at City Hall and so forth, we had a substantial number of perennials in the circle over there. And it was bad enough the tree was going to be lost, the Christmas tree and everything else, but I wasn't about ready to lose hundreds of dollars worth of perennials. Because besides the annuals, we had put in perennials. And some of them had survived very nicely, but the best had survived in front of City Hall. So we are bent over, we're with our buckets and so forth, and all of a sudden a police cruiser is by our side. Actually had come up on the sidewalk, and we looked up, and we didn't think anything of it. We just thought she's going to, I don't know what we were thinking, but we certainly weren't thinking that we were about to be arrested. So at any rate, a call had come in that some people were stealing the plants from in front of City Hall. So we explained who we were, and it happened to be that City Hall was still functioning, and a lady looked out her window, and she knew me, and she rushed out to the plaza in the front, and she said, no, 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 you can't arrest them. She's responsible for all the plants in town and everything else. So then somebody else came out and verified that I was not a thief. And that we were just, you know, replanting, you know, and so forth. But in the meantime, a second cruiser had come up. So there they are. We've got two police cars, two policemen, you know, with their guns at their sides and everything else. And we're thinking, this is going to be horrible. We're going to end up in the newspaper or something. But it didn't. They understood what it was. And I guess they let the police force know that we were okay. And we just replanted. We put things in other places. Yeah. But one other time, there was a planting by the bookstore on Third and River, and there was a monument there, and That was planted beautifully. And they were redoing the sidewalk, reconfiguring the corner. It was a little too sharp, so they were going to make it a rounder corner. So I went up to them and I told them that, you know, who I was and this had been planted and the evergreens were expensive and so forth, and there wouldn't be any difficulty. And they said, oh, absolutely not. We're just reconfiguring a little bit on the corner. They'll be fine. So the next day or 2 days later, I went there. Everything is gone. Everything was pulled up. Well, the evergreens, all the perennials, everything is gone, and there's poor concrete on the corner. And I went, I was just like, oh, my God, this is terrible. Well, at the time, we had an older worker for the city. His name was Clarence. And so I rushed to find Clarence, and because he did a lot of the beautification for the, well, the trimmings and so forth for the city. And he says, I don't know where they are, but I went to the dump by the golf course because I knew they had a dump site. I went everywhere that I could think of. They might have dumped those things because it had only been like a day and a half probably that they were out, so I was going to retrieve them. I never found them. So that was a terrible thing to happen because I had been assured, you know, that everything was going to be fine and dandy, and that was just a lovely, lovely planting there. So that was a mishap.
Yeah.
But for the most part, it went very well. Yeah, very pleased. And I walked around a little bit today and was very happy to see that a lot of the planters are where they were. A few of them have been adjusted, but they're looking wonderful. Absolutely. Marie and her crew are doing a lovely job.
What is it, do you think, about plants and having plants in the city particularly that, you know, makes such a difference to people and is such a meaningful kind of small change?
Well, when you have the taller buildings, though our buildings aren't that tall and so forth, but you have a lot of concrete. And there are people who live in apartments and don't have the opportunity to have a private garden and so forth and may not have a balcony. I think just walking on the street and it being within the sight line of pedestrians and so forth is refreshing. The colors, besides the colors, but just the idea. You do see some people smelling the flowers, so usually petunias and geraniums don't have much in the way of smell and so forth, but it just soothes the soul, I think, to be able to see that. A little touch of country, even if it is in a container and so forth, for those who aren't fortunate enough. And I've been always a big gardener all my life, so having it in small spaces, to me, is just as satisfying as having it in a big space.
Well, so this is the 25th.
It is.
Correct?
25th anniversary. And Marie called me up, and I hadn't even thought of it. And she said she wanted to do something to commemorate the 25th. And I said, oh, my goodness, is it already the 25th? And she said yes, and she invited me to come here to be interviewed. So I have to thank Marie for that. And it's been wonderful. We had a lovely lunch, and we've been walking around town. I did a little shopping, helped the economy a little bit. And it's been a grand day. So I thank you very much for the invitation.
Great. Marie, is there anything you want to say about Troy and Bloom and what your involvement has been with it now?
I think I'd prefer to say how impressed I was with how Claire made this happen 25 years ago and kept it going. She persevered. She, you know, planting the flowers is just a minor step, but having them maintained, it's so much more difficult. And there's no sense in planting them if they aren't maintained. And she did that all in volunteer ways. And that so impressed me. And to have started something that then lasted to this point and hopefully going forward, strictly as a volunteer effort, just amazes me. And I think a recognition of her is really important. And do her.
Well, I'm very touched. It was totally unexpected and so forth, and I'm really moved by the generosity that Marie has shown toward me and the sanctuary and so forth. So I thank you very much. Yes, it was a labor of love.
That was Claire Bourne of Troy in Bloom.
Last week, correspondent Tatiana Morani met with Melody Funches at the New York Association of Psychiatric Rehabilitation Services. Confronting Health Inequities, Let's Get Comfortable with Being Uncomfortable training. Melody Funches was the keynote speaker who talked about her personal experience with discrimination, disparities, and adversities, both in her personal and professional life.
Hi. Hi, Melanie. Can you tell me about how you got involved in this line of work?
Well, I think that this work found me. I'm a peer. I've been involved in systems, but I'm also the child of a person who had mental health challenges. And so through those things, I saw the need to be able to advocate for good mental health services and healing among people of color.
Can you talk about your talk today at the NIAPR's Let's Get Comfortable with Being Uncomfortable event was really focused on addressing racism and acknowledging racism. Can you talk about maybe why people are uncomfortable with addressing racism?
I think that racism is something that seems like so huge and is so pervasive that people feel that they have no power to fix it, or people don't want to be seen as bad people, and so they don't want to acknowledge that it exists. And all those things combined just perpetuate the problem. So I like to be able to come into the spaces to call a thing and say that racism is real. This is what it looks like. This is what happens, so that people can become comfortable talking about it, and then we can make moves to fix it.
That's true. I think people often are, their first reaction is to be defensive whenever you call them out. Have you had any experience where you've called someone out and they weren't defensive?
I think that I have, where they weren't defensive, but that is someone who has been doing their own work. You know, it's natural, like if you call somebody, you know, because people equate racism and perpetuating racism with bad people, because we relate it to, on the interpersonal level, talking about like people like the Klan and all that. But what is worse than that and more pervasive than that are the regular people who do nothing in the face of injustice, or people who are like that aversive racist who, you know, who won't stand and will say, oh, I'm with you in the corner, but won't stand with you in the time when you need them to stand, and all these other things that happen. So, I mean, most of the time I find that if you have someone who started to do their own work, they understand that racism is a system and that we're all born into it. And so we all have a role, even though we didn't create it, we all have a role in fixing it. And that I'm not, you know, that it's okay that we know that this is what it is, but it doesn't mean you have to stay that way.
In your TED Talk today, you kind of talked or touched on, you know, the African-American community feeling empowered, or how it was important for them to feel empowered to educate themselves and make change for themselves. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yes. What I talk about a lot is about wanting us to be the owners of the tools of our own healing. There is a great a large amount of scholarship around these issues that is created by us for us. And a lot of the work that I'm doing is around creating access to that knowledge for people of color, for Black folks, because the biggest part is not that we don't know or that the information doesn't exist. We just don't have access to it, because a lot of it is caught up in academia. So I feel part of my role is to help regular community people to have access to that knowledge in an accessible way.
How do you think we go about allowing people to have access to this knowledge?
There's a few things. One is to tell people that the knowledge exists. There's some people, you just got to tell them, hey, there's this article, and they have that they can go in and get the article and read it. Some other people may not understand all the academic jargon, so they need, like, I call myself a cultural broker. I exist in the space between regular community folks and academia to do that translation of, you know, well, when this person said that this is what they really saying, what they really mean is this, you know, and to be able to break it down into regular language, because a lot of times it's not that it's smarter language or it's more high, you know, higher language. It's just that it's a lot of jargon. Each of our areas has its own jargon, its own language, its own slang. And we just have to be able to translate it to make it more accessible to the general population.
It sounds like you're saying that a lot of the information that's out there is written in a way that's not culturally easily translatable. I wonder how you feel, or what your thoughts on education and the disparities in education and the public school system and how that affects the inequities we have.
There is a lot of information that is in academia, like higher ed, that is written in this seemingly academic-ese sort of language. But there's also books that are more accessible. There's just so much information. In reference to K-12 education and disparities, I think what happens there is about a crisis of low expectations for our young people, that the biases that exist create this feeling of low expectations so that we don't even expose our young people to different kinds of language, different kinds of books, different kinds of information. So when they get to this level, they don't know it, because not because they're not as bright, they're not as capable, is that they haven't been exposed.
Wow, that's actually really interesting. Thank you, Melanie. I really appreciate you talking with me today. And can you know, you just leave off with what can people do themselves, people that may be listening to this, to address health inequalities within themselves and within their communities?
There's a couple of things I want to leave you with. One is that risk factors are not predictive factors because of protective factors. A great man, Dr. Carl Bell, said that, and it's very true. The things that they say about us, the risk factors, are not predictive factors because of protective factors. Things that we have in our community, our village, our people, are protective for us. So if we embrace a lot of those things, they can be protective. Also, you cannot expect what you don't inspect. If we expect for us as a community to come forward and come through, we have to put in that work. We cannot expect our young people to soar to heights if we're not tending to them in school, and we're not checking in on them and seeing and checking on the teachers to make sure that we're holding teachers accountable to educating them. If we're not checking on them in community to make sure they know that there's caring adults who are looking out for them and looking out on them to know that we see them and we care about them. We've got to do these things, because there's some things that are outside of our control, but there's a whole lot of stuff that's within our control to really bring back our village and help our communities grow and heal and be well.
I like that. That's beautiful. Thank you so much.
Thank you for the opportunity.
You just heard Melanie Funches speaking to correspondent Tatiana Morani after NYAPRS's Confronting Health Inequities, Let's Get Comfortable with Being Uncomfortable training. To learn more about the New York Association of Psychiatric Rehabilitation Services and future events, you can visit their website at nyaprs.org. And that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Jonah Moberg.
And I'm J.P. Pogorski. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have comments, suggestions, or a tender confession, you can text us at 518-888-3004. Also be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
As a reminder, WOOC 105.3 is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org, or just stop by one of our weekly meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m., held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.